Yeah, I don't know how much.
Open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Laura, could you close that door? Thank you. And I will open up the work session on House Bill 2316.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2316 has a revenue statement issued and no fiscal impact. It excludes the pension income from lower income household and net worth definitions relating to individual development accounts.
So several weeks, committee, we heard this bill. I think there was no objection to it, so I think we will try to pass it today.
And Madam Chair,
yes,
there is an amendment in everybody's packet.
Okay, and you want to tell us what the amendment does?
It modifies ORS 458.680 to include language that excludes holdings in pension accounts as defined by Housing and Community Services Department by rule that are valued at less than $60,000.
That's right.
Okay. We would have to do the dash one amendment first.
Dash two, I believe.
Dash two amendment? Okay.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I may, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 2/12/13 to House Bill 2316.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the dash two amendment dated 3/12/13 to House Bill 2316. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2316 as we just amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2316 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Gallego?
Yes.
Representative Gelser?
Yes.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Kitty
Geyer? Aye.
Representative Wisnan?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Fulmer?
Aye. The bill has passed, and who should carry that? Whose bill was it? Representative Buckley. Let's have Representative Buckley carry that.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on 2316. Open up a work session on 3129.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3129 has no revenue statement and a fiscal statement was issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and it's my understanding that there is an amendment and there is somebody here to explain that.
Okay. Staff person, thank you so much for coming today. Just
good
identify
afternoon.
Yourself.
Yes. Hi, I'm Marissa. I'm Marissa Johnson from Representative Michael Dembo's office.
Great.
Chair, members of the committee, the dash one amendment to 3129 changes the original bill, which would have created a board to certify professional fiduciaries, a professional fiduciary being a fiduciary who serves more than three or more people as a paid guardian or conservator. The new dash one amendment would require the professional fiduciaries in the state of Oregon to have a national certified guardian or national master guardian certificate, which is issued by the Center for Guardian Certification. And this would enable us to have oversight over folks providing that role to prevent any anyone being taken advantage of by someone in this role, and to have a process for grievance, and also would serve to level the playing field between those who act as professional fiduciaries in the state. So we urge your aye vote, and I'm here if you have any questions. There's a dash one amendment brief that I've provided to you that should be on the dais as well.
Thank you. Any questions? And I understand it's your first time testifying in front of the committee, and you did a great job.
Boy, so, thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt the dash one amendment stated 3/14/13 to House Bill 3129.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the dash three, did you say?
Excuse me, dash one, did I
dash
say?
One, dash one amendment dated 3/14/13 to House Bill 3129. Any discussion? Any objection? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3129 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 3129 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? I think this is a really good bill, and I think Representative Dembo has done a really terrific job on this, and it was one that was really needed. And this is one of those times when I think we're happy to be here as legislators to have some good things happening. So if any other discussion? Seeing none, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos.
Yes.
Representative Gelser.
Yes.
Representative Gilliam.
Representative Gilliam.
Yes.
Hi, Madam Chair.
Did he say aye or aye?
Aye.
He said aye. Call. Yes.
For you. 3129.
I don't trust the chair.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Penny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomberg.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. The motion passes, and the bill is amended, is sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
I didn't know we were going to vote the same.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If we're still in work session, would Representative Gilliam want to vote on the dash one amendments? Or?
Let's do that later because
okay.
People have to go elsewhere.
Okay.
Okay, so we are going to be opening up. I closed the work session on House Bill 3129. Open up the work session on House Bill 2971.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2971 has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement was issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It appropriates to the Department of Human Services for the biennium beginning July 1, 2013 from the general fund $1,880,000 for the enhancement and expansion of independent living center services to persons with disabilities. It declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. You may remember we had this hearing last week, how time flies, and I think we were all so impressed. We would have liked to have passed the bill that day, but it was a great deal of money, and I thought we should wait and see if we have any more thoughts about it. But I'm so excited to have a work session on this bill today. So,
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2971 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2971 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Chair, I just want to say that, again, this is another bill that I think makes us especially proud to be here and to pass this kind of legislation.
Yes, thank you. Any further discussion?
Just, Madam Chair, I concur, and that was really a heartfelt testimony.
It was very moving. Any further discussion? All right. It was moved, right? And we had discussion. And Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative
Kim Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Wisnan.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomberg.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
And Chair Tomei.
Aye. The motion passes, and it goes on to Ways and Means. I'm going to reopen the work session on House.
Oops. Sorry. Excuse me.
That's going to reopen.
Never mind.
Okay. I was going to reopen the House, the work session, House Bill 2316. Representative Gilliam, would you like to vote on that bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would.
Pardon?
You just need to say you're suspending the
vote. I'm suspending the rules. To allow Representative Gilliam the opportunity to vote on House Bill 2316.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam votes aye. With that, we will close the House Bill, the work session on House Bill 2316. Did you have something? Okay. And now we will open up the public hearing on House Bill 3244.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3244 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It modifies the age of runaway and homeless youth for whom the Department of Human Services must recommend policies for a system of services and support.
And we have a list of people. Thank you, dear. Okay. We have Janet Arends, Mike Balter, and Dan Klein. Klein, is that right? Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Janet Arends. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. I'll keep this very brief. Runaway and Homeless System, the Alliance represents about $205 million worth of services in Oregon. The lion's share of runaway and homeless providers are also members of the Alliance. And consistent with the state's own child welfare system and foster care system, which serves youth up to the age of 21, and the federal child welfare system, which serves runaway and homeless youth up to the age of 22, we would like the state's own runaway and homeless system to also be consistent with those ages. The reason that that's important is because of the transitioning that young adults have between the ages of 18 and 21. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
Hi, I'm Mike Balter. I'm CEO of Boys and Girls Aid. We're a 130-year-old organization here in Oregon. We've been serving homeless youth since 1885. And I think times have changed since then. And what I wanted to assure you that the notion of 18-year-olds being able to emancipate and be on their own just isn't working. So we strongly encourage the passage of this bill. We've worked at this for about 4 years. It seems like a technical adjustment to me, but it's more, always a little more complicated than that. We'd recommend that you adopt this change, and we work closely with the Department of Human Services. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Why don't you go ahead and speak, and then we'll see if anyone has any questions for any of you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Cran, I'm the Tillamook County Juvenile Department Director, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, who is also in support of this bill for all of the reasons that Jen and Michael said. This is a common sense sort of move to make the ages match up over the spectrum of the services that are provided. This is a work that's been going on for a really long time, as they said, and the Juvenile Department Directors have been involved in this work from the beginning since runaway youth tend to come in contact with the juvenile system, and it makes sense to extend this age to include those young people that are transitioning into adulthood, and that those services begin. I mean, you talk about kids that are 17 and kids that are 19, their needs are basically the same, and this is just a common sense move on everybody's part, and I appreciate the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you so much. Any questions, any of these folks? Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. So this is basically, do I understand, allowing legal adults to receive services and support along with minors, or is it up to the age of 21, not through the age of 21?
Chair Tomei and Representative, the amendment that you see in front of you and the purpose of the bill is to allow us to serve homeless youth ages 18 through 21.
Okay, but may I follow up? My question then is, depending on the type of services that are offered, could this cause a potential problem having legal adults in the same place as minors?
Chair Tomei and Representative, the considerations are made for that, and Mike and Dan can speak directly to their programs.
Yeah, so for Boys and Girls Aid, the services that are generally provided to the older youth are transitional living services, and so they're generally around an individual. They're not living in congregate care. And they are, at that point, at 19, 20, 21, are in association with each other anyway. We serve young people up to 23 because the age of maturation has just changed. Any of you who have young adult children, many of them have probably returned home to live with you at different times. This is that same transition that these young people are trying to get through. So we have not had any complications. We've been serving that pairing of young people for quite a long time, and the federal government allows that at age 23. That's a good question. Thank you.
Okay. Representative, wasn't it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, you addressed emancipation. This is not affecting you. I think in Oregon at 16 years old, you can be emancipated. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Winsett, you know, I'm not a legal expert on this. I think Dan could probably speak to this better. You know, we're dealing with the issue of the realities of emancipation, and I think young people can decide that they're adults in some ways, particularly in certain care situations. I think it's highly ill-advised, but I think you're correct, and Dan, maybe you can speak to that.
Madam Chair and Representative Winsett, nice to see you. Emancipated youth at 16, it is legal to become emancipated, but that test is really that you can take care of yourselves. And what we're talking about here is a group of young people that are having difficulty meeting their needs all the way past where you actually reach the age of majority at 18. So even though you can become emancipated, I think what the bill is trying to accomplish and what this work is trying to accomplish is assisting those that are off track to actual emancipation to get back on that track of emancipation again. The answer to your question is yes, you can be emancipated at 16, but you have to convince a circuit court judge that you can take care of yourself and meet all your needs.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Dan, good to see you. We served together on the Commission for Children and Family, the State Commission. Back to Representative Wissett talked about this. We have in Central Oregon a home and a shelter for runaways and homeless. Mm-hmm. And now, are we allowed with this? Could we prioritize that younger, you know, and you could have a situation here of a 21-year-old and some much younger living in that home. Is the legislation allowing us to prioritize or to not, you know, the rooms? I think it's more concerned about a young adult living on the street than a...
Representative, what's it, Madam Chair? At least in our situation, it's Boys and Girls, and I believe this is statewide, is that our license takes care of that.
Pull back from there.
Our license takes care of that. We have to segregate 18-year-olds. So our shelter, it's 18 and under. In fact, it's 17 up to 18. So we don't commingle those two in the same shelter. Now, in an apartment complex where you have apartments, there could be young people living on different floors, but generally not sharing the same space. At least, again, I think that's probably applicable generally if you have a licensed shelter, which most of those are.
Any further questions? Representative Kenny Gelser.
Thank you.
Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm honored to be associated with Representative Gelser.
Likewise.
Just saying on the Portland Children's Levy, we were moving the age up to 25 on a lot of the programs, for instance, foster youth who age out and really still need assistance. They can't just, like, go off a cliff. So I'm very supportive. I believe it does say through 21 instead of to 21. But I think that emerging brain science has shown that we do need that extra time.
And let's clarify that. So are you addressing the -2 amendment? Is anyone supporting that?
Yes, Chair.
And that does say through 21 years of age.
Yes.
So is that what the intent now? It's through 21.
Correct, okay. Madam Chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. Madam Chair. Yeah, I just have a question. Can you clarify, I mean, what kind of services are we talking about? I mean, I assume there's sort of job training, readiness, that kind of thing. What?
Mm-hmm. Just an example, maybe.
Representative.
Not too close.
Gallegos. I actually have a handout that, you know, speaks directly to our services that range everything from temporary shelter care, maybe 10 days, so we can straighten out whether this young person needs to be reunited with their family, which we also do in mediation services, to skill track services, employment, education, self-sufficiency training, mental health counseling for the transitioning young people. If we're seeing them on a track where they have to live on their own, there's a lot of skills to develop. And sometimes we'll work with young people as long as 2 years. And I have actually.
Could I get my daughter into your program? Is that
Representative, we would go with mediation reunification first. If you wound up in the shelter, which you could, obviously, we would first come to you and say, this is something we can work through with you.
Any further questions? As far as I can see, there is no fiscal, right, on this?
That's right.
And so I see somebody from the agency is here. Does the agency want to say anything about this? Nobody looks like they're eager. Okay, terrific. Any other questions or concerns? All right, thank you so much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3244 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3445.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3445 has no revenue impact in the fiscal statement, was issued, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It directs the Department of Human Services to determine whether there are alternative placement options for child award in department's custody before committing child award to residential care or residential treatment. It requires the department to utilize state and federal funds designated for residential care or residential treatment for certain services when implementing alternative placement options.
Great. We have a very distinguished panel.
We do.
And then we have Representative Gallegos and Representative Gilliam.
Gelser.
Gelser. Everyone's Gelser today.
I'm glad you missed me.
I did miss you. I'm trying to make up for it. I'm the president.
I am Representative Gallegos. House District 30. New Hillsborough, I should say. North Plains and part of Helvetia. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you about this bill, 3445. Foster care for children started in the United States back in 1853. Since then, many children have walked through the foster care system. Right now, Oregon has more than 9,000 children in foster care. This is roughly 10 out of every 1,000 children, and it's twice the national average for a state our size. Actually, Oregon is like number 33 now it ranks in terms of foster care. Our current system allows the movement of foster care children from residential home to residential home in order to provide the intensive services foster care foster children need. This creates a cycle, a cyclical cycle that constantly moves children around. This environment does not promote stability. Instead, it creates a system of poor outcomes. I'll share with the committee sort of a personal story. Some of you know that I have a background as a migrant worker when I was a kid here in the Willamette Valley, and I got pulled out of school early in the spring, and then we'd usually work through the summer, and I'd start late. As a result, my family, basically every year, we'd find a new rental, low-income housing in Portland. As a result of that, I attended no less than 10 grade schools, different grade schools. So every year I was in a different grade school. And I guess that I think about that when I think about these kids getting moved around, I know how traumatic it was to every year not know who my peers were going to be, what my friends were going to be, my house was going to be, et cetera, et cetera. So I can just imagine what it's like to be a foster care kid getting moved around and being that disrupted in their life at that formative kind of stage. So, like I said, it's my experience is nowhere near this, but I can imagine how difficult that would be. So House Bill 3445 is an important step to ensuring that Oregon's youth, the kids we're charged with caring for, are given the best shot at permanency as early as possible. Furthermore, it ensures that we meet the needs of our foster children where they need it most, in their home. This also reduces the instability of moving them from home to home. And again, just think about the stress that must create on these young lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gallegos. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Vic Kenny Gelser from South. Did I say that wrong?
Uh-huh.
Vic Gilliam from.
Scary.
Sounded good.
From Silverton. And I appreciate the context and the personal story from my good friend here to my left. I did not know we'd had foster care for that long in Oregon, but I did know that I think it's Representative Jensen was the original foster child in Oregon. I don't know if people are aware of that. If the idea behind, see, Regina, he's really old, and so is it kind of an old joke. If the idea behind foster care is for children to have relationships, even the window of a relationship, when those doors have been slammed shut, and if the ministry of foster care, if you will, is to provide stability where there was none, then we need a bill like this, or we need this bill to flip the system around. And I know it's not easy, I know it's not necessarily inexpensive, but I think it's very important that we do provide stability, and that instead of designing a system that has become a priority, it has become to design it for the parents, excuse me, the adults who are administering the program, we need to put the kids first. And although my last name is not Gelser, we should have learned that from Representative Gelser by now. In these situations, we've got to put children first, design programs for children, and that's, I think, what this does. It'll cut down immensely, if we follow the prescription of this bill, it'll cut down immensely on the number of foster homes kids have to be transferred to, and rather, it'll bring services to those children, so that those relationships that they start don't suddenly get chopped off again and they get moved to another foster home. I look forward to more discussion on this bill, and I thank you for the chance to help kick off the bill with my representative friend here.
Thank you, both representatives. Any quick questions? Representative Whitsett.
I do, for Representative Gallegos. Do you have any idea statistically why Oregon has so many more foster children than other states of its size? You mentioned that. Do we know why?
Well, you know, we had the presentation in Ways and Means within the last couple of weeks, and I'm trying to remember what they said was the reason, and I can't for the life of me. But I mean, I can propose that it has to do with the poverty level in the state. I mean, we've been number one in terms of hunger and just poverty, yeah, it's so high. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But I think also that it's a system, and I think this is a great fix to the system that will help that.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Yes. Is it going to be staff going to testify?
There will be other people to testify.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With this, we will call up the Honorable Paul DeMunis, Jim Seymour. Is Aubrey Boyce, is that correct? And Jessica Adamson. Welcome. Please identify yourselves before you speak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Adamson, here today on behalf of Catholic Community Services. My job today is just to introduce these distinguished panel who will share with you more about why House Bill 3445 is so necessary, what it does, and why we believe it will help take the resources we currently have in the system and use them, refocus them on permanency, particularly around youth in our foster care system that are in community homes. We believe this bill has the power to really change lives and make a big difference for youth that have really struggled and had some pretty compelling life stories. So here with us today is Chief Justice Muniz, Jim Seymour, who's the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services and been working with these homes for a long time, and Aubrey Boyce, who is a tremendous young lady who has been through an incredible life story and has been part of a community home, can tell you firsthand what those experiences are like.
Thank you. Welcome to our humble abode.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Paul DeMunis, and I'm a law school teacher, presently.
and a little something other.
Thank you for the
honor. Yes, swearman first. That's
of being here. Most of our presentation will be by Jim Seymour and Aubrey Boyce, but I wanted to be here just to share a brief story with you. In my private life, I have been involved with Catholic Community Services in the area, in two areas. One, we have a cutting-edge program, which is a neighborhood a collective impact program called Fostering Hope, in which we're in neighborhoods in Salem and in McMinnville. And the goal there is to reduce the maltreatment of children so that we reduce those children going into foster care. In addition, I've had the privilege of being involved with Catholic Community Services in the Cutting Edge program that I'm sure many of you have heard of, and those are our community homes that we have. We have six community homes here in Marion, Yamhill, and Polk counties, and these were originally called Forever Homes. The idea being that we would change the paradigm, that children who were not thriving in foster care, and these were kids who were long-term placement, Jim will, you all know the term applicant kids, but kids for which there was no other permanent plan, kids not thriving in these counties who had been in and out of residential treatment eventually would come to our forever homes. And I have seen the success, the personal success for these children who start to thrive in our forever homes. And so I want to relate one story to you about why this bill is exceedingly important. Last December, a few days before Christmas, I went up to Woodburn to have dinner in one of our forever homes with five of our boys. And one of those young men, the youngest, they ranged from 17 to 12. The youngest boy in that home, and believe me, he has a great personality. He is able to banter with the Chief Justice back and forth. He's 12 years old. He had been in 40 foster homes. 40. No child should be subject to that. He had been 40 foster homes. He had been so traumatized that when he came to this home, it took 3 months before he would take his clothes out of the paper bag and put him in the dresser available for them, because he knew he wasn't going to last. He hadn't been in a regular school, and he was smart. He hadn't been in a regular school. He'd had to go to a special school. They had to take him all the way to Dallas. But by the time I got to have dinner with him, he'd put his clothes away. He was comfortable there. And he was beginning to transition to a regular school. He was 12 years old. That's why we need this bill. Jim and Audrey know more of the details than I do, but I thought it was important, at least for me, to share with you that story. So thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley and Central Coast. Catholic Community Services is a state-licensed and nationally accredited social service organization that provides several types of social services to more than 2,000 children, youth, and adults each year. We provide foster care, treatment foster care, and residential treatment for more than 100 children and youth on any given day. While this total only represents approximately 10% of the Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County foster children, it is the 10% with the most serious behavior and emotional problems. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 3445. In 2010, Governor Ted Kulongowski and Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, Paul Dominguez, signed a memo of understanding jointly declaring the safe and equitable reduction of the number of children in Oregon's foster care system to be among the top priorities of this state. House Bill 3445 is designed to help the state achieve this important goal in a manner that improves foster care outcomes and reduces costs for Oregon taxpayers. The Adoption and Safe Families Act and Oregon Administrative Rules require the Department of Human Services to develop, document, and implement a permanency plan for every child placed in the department's legal custody for substitute care placement. There are six permanency designations: reunification, adoption, guardianship, permanent placement with a fit and willing relative, Community Guardianship, and APLA, which stands for Another Planned Permanent Living Arrangement. APLA usually equates to long-term foster care and is seldom seen as the best permanency plan for foster children. It is frequently asserted that APLA denies foster children real stability in a nurturing home, and yet it remains the permanency plan for 15% of Oregon foster children. While in long-term foster care, many children experience multiple disrupted placements, lose contact with caring relatives, move far away from the neighborhoods and schools where people knew and cared about them, and often develop even more severe behavior and emotional problems. House Bill 3445 is intended to provide these children and youth with what they need most: safe, stable, nurturing relationships. The bill is aligned with the principle of subsidiarity, which asserts that social matters ought to be handled by the smallest, lowest, or least centralized competent authority. The common sense version of subsidiarity asserts that we shouldn't do things for individuals, families, or communities that they can and should do for themselves. When we do so, it not only breeds dependency, but it also wastes precious resources. If a youth's family is unwilling or unable to reclaim the youth from foster care, and there is no one stepping forward to adopt the youth or to be the youth's guardian, then the community, rather than the state, should become the next line of defense. The problem that House Bill 3445 begins to address is that current public policy in Oregon encourages child welfare practitioners to move children with serious emotional and behavior problems into foster care, and then when foster parents are unable to meet the children's needs, to move them again to treatment foster care, then to residential treatment, and perhaps even to into secure residential treatment. Then, because each tier of the continuum of care costs more to provide, there is constant pressure to move the children back down the tiers until the child reaches a level that no longer meets their needs, and the vicious cycle starts all over again. Every disrupted placement tends to solidify the child's sense of not being wanted or loved, sets the child back academically and socially, and increases the severity of emotional and behavioral problems. House Bill 3445 begins to address this problem by allowing funds that currently can only be used to provide treatment foster care, residential treatment, and secure residential treatment to be used more flexibly in support of parents and foster parents who are fit and willing to provide a safe, stable, nurturing home for a child with serious emotional and behavior problems, but need support to do so. Credible scientific evidence supports the premise that safe, stable, nurturing relationships are the key social determinant of a child's health, success at school, and future financial self-sufficiency. Catholic Community Services has been testing this premise locally for more than a decade using funds provided by a local philanthropist. We have found that 80% of the children and youth who were not thriving in regular foster care, as evidenced by multiple disrupted placements, are able to live responsibly in a safe, stable, nurturing home when the supports like the ones identified in House Bill 3445 are made available. In addition, we have found that these supports can be provided for a fraction of the cost of moving a foster child to treatment foster care or residential treatment. If you would look at the diagram that I provided titled the Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County Foster Care System, you will see that 80 to 100 Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County children enter foster care, the foster care system each month. You will also see that between 80 and 100 children exit the foster care system each month. This keeps the average daily foster care population fairly stable at about 1,000 children on any given day. If you look at the bottom of the diagram, you will see that about 150 children are on the APLA designation. About half of the APLA kids are thriving. They are the ones that have found a foster parent who is providing a safe, stable, nurturing home. Unfortunately, however, the other half of the APLA kids are not thriving. These are the kids that House Bill 3445 will help us to reach. With me today is Aubrey Boyce. Aubrey is one of the youth who have benefited from having the opportunity to live responsibly in a safe, stable, nurturing home. She serves on our Forever Home Youth Council and would like to share a part of her story with you. Thank you again for the opportunity to share with you our support of House Bill 3445. And later, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aubrey Boyce. I am 18 years old and a senior at Sprague High School here in Salem. I was neglected and abused as a baby and placed into foster care when I was 18 months old. I went back to live with my mom when I was 2.5 years old. With my mother's health at a low point, I re-entered foster care again when I was 3. After about a year, the state sent me to live with my grandmother. She struggled with her health too and decided it was best to have me live temporarily with my aunt and uncle when I was 5. Unfortunately, my aunt was an alcoholic and her kids were drug addicts, so that placement did not last long. When my grandmother felt better, she had me come back to California after 3 short months in Oregon. Eventually, my grandmother's health deteriorated so badly she was no longer able to care for me and my older brother. She passed away when I was 7 years old. My mother passed away just 4 days after my grandmother, a mere 4 rooms down the hall in the hospital. As you can imagine, I was in shock. I remember hiding under a table because I didn't want anyone to find me and take me away to another new place. I ended up being placed back with my aunt and uncle again in Oregon. At first, my aunt only abused me mentally, but when she started drinking again, she abused me physically too. Life was far from joyful. I have to admit that it was a sigh of relief when she passed away. My uncle never began to be home after my aunt died. There was never food in the house, so I just roamed around the neighborhood getting into trouble. Eventually, I was placed back into foster care. By then, I was too afraid to let anyone care for me because everyone who had tried either walked out on me or had died. This began to change, though, when I went to live at one of Catholic Community Services community homes for children. There have been many bumps in the road along the way, but they have kept their word and they have not given up on me. I'm going to graduate from high school this year. I have a part-time job at CCS that I love, and I have obtained my driver's license and essentially did a complete turnaround with my life. I plan to go into college and next year, I plan to go into college next year, and Catholic Community Services has promised me that they will stand behind me just like any good parent would until I'm out of college and I can support myself. I feel confident about my future, and I don't want to let the people who care about me down. I urge you to support House Bill 3445. I can assure you that until I had a safe, stable, nurturing home, I didn't trust anyone or anything, but now I have a good home and high hopes for the future.
Thank you for sharing your story, Aubrey. You make us all cry. Aubrey, how is it that you got referred to Catholic Family Services?
It was actually, there was a, after my aunt died, I went to go live with a family friend. They were one of my first friends when I moved up here from California, because I'm originally from California. And, you know, their mom had said, you know, we feel bad for you, just come live with us. And they became foster parents just strictly for me. And I had lived there. And then their mom had, like, bipolar. And so she just started having, like, a lot of health issues. And there was a lot of, like, back and forth, like, oh, we want her, we don't want her, we're not getting paid enough, we're not, you know, we don't know what to do. And so eventually, there was one week where she just said, well, we want to get rid of her. And then the next week, they're like, well, we don't. And then they actually ended up not even telling me that I was getting removed from their home. I was told by having my caseworker literally come to the house that day and told me to pack my bags and leave because they said that they couldn't handle it anymore. And so I just remember being taken out of the DHS office, and then they told me, well, we have a house for you to go to. I was told later on that this was the last placement. They had no open homes for me to go to, and they just sent me to the community home, and I didn't really know anybody there for like a month. It was very weird. Like, they just kind of shoved me in here, but I mean, it ended up being for the better instead of the worst.
How old were you then, Aubrey?
I was just going into, I've been there since, my intake date was November 7th, 2008.
So you've been there
for
four and a half years. Congratulations. It sounds
you.
Like you've done some wonderful things with your life. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome.
So I have some questions, Mr. Seymour. So I wrote down that you, and maybe it's in your written testimony also, but there is a philanthropist who is providing funds. So that's one of the things I'm wondering. How do you fund these homes?
The Oregon Department of Human Services has been supportive of the community home concept. They recognize the need to provide a more stable home, and so they provide foster care payments to the foster parents. But Catholic Community Services receives no additional funding to make this commitment. But what we have found is that it requires, in a home that serves up to five children, that it takes between $30,000 to $50,000 per home, not per child, but per home, with three to five children in that home, in order to keep the commitment that we have made that we won't give up. Those supports go into providing additional support to the caregiver, just to make sure that the caregivers, the way we've come to think about it, is if the stress level gets to the level that it's toxic with the caregiver, they get into sort of a fight-flight behavior themselves. And so we, with the foster parents, have to keep the stress level down. And that costs us between $30,000 and $50,000 per year per home for three to five kids. And that those funds have been provided by a local philanthropist for the six homes that we have open, that we are just at the place where we, after 10 years, see that this really works. It costs less than having kids go back and forth in the system. And so without costing taxpayers any more, in fact, costing taxpayers less, we believe this bill will allow us to scale up so that there are no children in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County who are not thriving.
DHS is providing some of these funds as well as this philanthropist in
yes.
the community.
The Chief Justice just reminded me that part of the strategy that makes this work is that we do a capital campaign for each home, and we raise the money to build a nice new home for these kids, and there's no mortgage on it. So a capital campaign, usually a home, we're building a home, buying a lot and building a home for about $300,000. So our community builds the children a home and says, this is your home. Catholic Community Services owns it, but it's here for you. They just hold it in trust for you. Okay, this is your home. And then we recruit the foster parents to come in and take care of the children in the children's home. So if the foster parents decide to quit fostering, they have to leave, not the kids. And the kids get to stay there. So the additional cost of this is being able to raise the money in order for us to make this work. We've had to be in a position where we weren't making mortgage payments, and that's another part of the fundraising. We have found that it'd be incredibly easy to do when we go into a community and say, you know, we've got kids who were taken into protective custody, they were your neighbor's children, and they don't have a home, nobody's stepping forward to adopt them, they're bouncing around in the foster care system right now.
So DHS refers these children to your program?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
And must they be Catholic children?
Oh, no.
Okay. And is there a religious component to this?
There is a spiritual component to it. We really do encourage people to examine their own faith, the faith of their family, the faith of their community. We think that a voluntary spiritual commitment is a part of what creates
Could you define that for us, what a voluntary spiritual commitment would be?
Well, we definitely bend over backwards to make sure that we're not promoting Catholicism, but we really do take a look at, well, what is your family's spiritual history, and what is, you know, lots of times there's a grandma or a grandpa or somebody that has a deep spiritual connection, and so we really do think encouraging young people to make a connection. What happens lots of times is that our foster parents, most of them come, and most of our foster parents are people of faith, and they go to church. We tell the youth, if you don't want to go to church, you don't have to go to church. We will have somebody come and be there with you. But eventually, most of the kids start going to church with their foster parents, and they make connections there. They find out that it's those social connections, and it's that opportunity to start to believe in a higher power, I guess. But we do not proselytize. We do not promote a faith. In fact, we sort of be very, very careful to make sure we don't. Part of the reason I mentioned that our organization is nationally accredited as a social service organization is to emphasize the fact that we operate with the highest professional standards.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Kinnegar. Was he first?
I think he was first.
Okay, go.
Ladies first.
Okay, thank you. Well, I was actually going to ask about gender. Do you have girls' homes and boys' homes, and what's the age range? In one case, you said 12 to 17. How young do you take the kids?
Chair to me, Representative Kinnegar. We would love to have the children come in when they're about 8 years old. What we have seen is that kids who are lingering in foster care with multiple disrupted placements. Most of the kids we serve, like Aubrey, have come in as infants up to 3 years old. But it takes 3 or 4 years before you get that sense of whether or not someone's going to adopt them or they're going to be reclaimed, because there's no way we want to interfere with that process. But by the time the kids have been in care for 5 years, and if they haven't been adopted, mm-hmm. and if they haven't been reclaimed by their parents, then there's a good chance that what they really need now is this safe, stable, nurturing home. Mm-hmm. Our actual referrals tend to come in more like when kids are 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. And it'll happen when either a young person from Marion, Polk, or Yamhill County is in a residential treatment program and they don't have any aftercare, and again, there's this pressure to bring them home, and so we open our doors. Or it's a situation where a child that's been in a foster home and now there's another disrupted placement, and we say if that's the case, then bring them to us, and we won't give up. We won't quit.
Okay, follow up. And right now, can DHS not refer kids to be in a foster placement in your home and pay the monthly? Is it not allowed right now, and this would now allow it as one of the options? Or actually prioritize it? I'm trying to understand what's different.
Madam Chair, Representative Kinnegar, so what this bill allows, right now they do pay for placement in these homes. They pay a foster care rate. The difference is, in these homes, we know that the children that are coming into these homes require additional services. Mm-hmm. They require wraparound supports to among the things listed in House Bill 3445 to help make them successful for the long term in these homes. Mm-hmm. In order to achieve those services today, the way the system works is that kids have to move. They move around different residential and sometimes up to secure residential treatment and then back down the system. Mm-hmm. Our commitment in a community home is, no, we are not going to move you. You've had enough movement, enough disruption in your life. This is your forever home. We're going to make that commitment to you. Through private fundraising, mm-hmm. we come in and provide those additional supports. What we believe it makes good sense is to allow those services that would be available if we were allowing those kids to move up the treatment ladder, instead of moving the child, let's bring those services in using that funding stream that would be available if we were willing to let our kids move, which we don't think is the best thing for them. Mm-hmm. We're saying instead, let's make permanency and stability mm-hmm. the priority, bring the services to the kids using the funds that would otherwise pay for those, and let's not move the kids to do that. Let's leave them in one place and bring those services to them.
Thank you.
Representative Wissett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask about some of the things that my colleague asked about. But, Madam Chair, I think if you remember a couple of sessions ago, I think on Judiciary, you and I and Representative Olson, we passed a bill authorizing children to be sent to the Catholic community homes. The other question I have is, do you take children in through other means than DHS? You know, someone comes to you and says, would you take this child or would you help this child? Or do all of your children come through DHS?
Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnett, no. All of the youth in the community homes that this bill really is about are children who are not thriving in the current foster care system. They're in the care and custody of the state. And if I could, just, this isn't in response to your question, but I really want to say, if you look at this, what this sort of tells you is that out of 1,000 children that the foster care system is serving the vast majority of them pretty well. So sometimes when we give testimony, it sounds like none of the foster care kids are getting good service, and I don't want to give that impression. But what I am trying to say to you is there's 75 kids just in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County who simply aren't thriving, and our experience is that 80% of them can thrive.
How do you find them? I think, is that what you're asking?
They're children. They're children who are in the system. They're already in the care and custody, and they, like I say, there's another disrupted placement, and so the worker is frantically looking for someone to take them, the DHS worker. Or they've been in a residential treatment program maybe sometimes 2 or 3 years because they don't have any aftercare placement. And what we tell the workers is if you've got a kid from Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County who's been placed outside of our county and you want to bring them home, we'll take them. We don't want Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County kids in another state or even in another county. This is our community's responsibility to raise these kids up.
And it would be really helpful to me, and maybe for you too, if we could see a history. I mean, I understand about Forever Homes, and it sounds like they're wonderful, but it also sounds like the home is owned by the agency, and I'd like to know about the foster parents, how they're recruited, and how long they stay in a foster home if they come and go, because that certainly would be disruptive to the children who are there. But I'm hearing that the referrals do come from DHS. Is that correct?
Yes,
for kids,
yes,
who need this most specialized care? And a question, Representative Kenny Geyer, I thought you were going to be asking this one, but do you take gay and homosexual kids?
Yes. We don't discriminate on any basis. We serve anybody that has a need.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. And we'd like to get back, I think, with any other information. I feel like I need more information about the agency and who you serve and how you serve and how long.
We'd be happy to get you any information.
Great. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you, Aubrey.
Thank you.
And we have Janet Arends.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, for the opportunity to come back up and comment. My name is Janet Arends. I'm the director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, and I think you already know about us. I just want to say I wore the wrong mascara for this hearing. Very powerful story.
Yes.
And Jim is a very powerful visionary for children in Oregon. He and I go way back, although neither of us will name a date, but we were in college together and have been colleagues along the way on this same mission. We support, of course, the bill and its mission. That's not hard to do. What is hard to do is trying to address funding challenges in this current environment. Concern in the proposal for funding for this is that it takes dollars away from residential and other care opportunities that are targeted for children who need that level of care. It's not residential care who harms children. It's the moves. And placing the child in the right place at the right time for the right service, where you're going to get the right outcomes, is going to reduce costs and reduce the number of moves for the children. And ideally, I mean, our position would be, frankly, that any dollar that's available in Oregon's budget should potentially be available for children's services, and that we shouldn't restrict possible funding options for these kinds of programs and these kinds of opportunities by restricting it just to a small, narrow piece of an already underfunded child welfare system.
Thank you. Any questions of Janet? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I wouldn't call a successful system that moved people 40 times in their early life.
Well done, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Guy. Oh, Gilliam?
I just wanted to point out, I've got, again, from the testimony from the Ways and Means Committee that I was in, that just a statement I'll read. The financial cost for one child to remain in foster care in Oregon for just 1 year is at minimum $26,600. And I think at $26,000 per child per year, I mean, compared to what we're talking about in terms of having four or five in a home for $50,000, I think really is more cost effective.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know how hard it is for all of you in all of our services right now, so I appreciate what you're saying. And this is a model, and I am so grateful as a state representative from the Mid-Willamette Valley that Jim and Catholic Services are here. Mm-hmm. But if it's a model we can replicate, it seems to me we certainly could save a lot of money. Now, that doesn't necessarily help us in this biennium, but looking forward, the need is so great, and the need that we hear in this committee in all areas, all ages, is so great, hopefully coming out of a recession. This, as you well know, the needs are multiplied. So I appreciate a very friendly criticism on your part, but I want to be sure that you are clear on the potential here for long-range savings, because we need partners. This state needs partners, and the person that would back me up, I believe, is the new fairly new director of Human Services. They need charitable, faith-based, and other partners, just like this one, to stretch these dollars.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, Representative Whitson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Zornis, I didn't mean to attack you either. I apologize. But I think this is I've been here long enough in the building to know that we do have good people in the foster care, and we also have problems. And I'm disappointed, Madam Chair. I thought someone from DHS was going to testify, because in the financial impact, they talk about how there's going to be a financial impact, which we all know could kill this bill. And I'd like to maybe get input on my own or however to see what they think the financial impact is and why they don't have this just another resource, another tool in their toolbox to take care of these needy children. And I understand the impact on other services that DHS provides, but I support what Representative Gilliam said as far as this seems like the special need for special people when a child's been in 40 foster homes in the early part of their life, and even the respected member of this committee.
Thank you very much, Representative. And I suggest we all look at the analysis, this fiscal impact analysis, and we'll try to get more information. In fact, what I think I'm going to do is continue the hearing, so maybe we could call somebody back to understand the fiscal analysis.
Thank you.
Another question?
Yes.
I would just like to thank the panel, previous panel, for such wonderful testimony. It was absolutely fabulous. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. With that, we're going to, how do I do that? But I'm going to leave it open. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3445, and we'll carry it over for another meeting to get more information. So thank you very much. Thank you all. And with that, we'll open up the public hearing on House Bill 2984.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2984 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It appropriates funds to the Department of Education out of the general fund to be expended for Early Childhood Development Center at Earl Boyles Elementary School. It declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you.
Welcome to
Hi, Madam Chair and colleagues. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, and I represent House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. For those of you who were here the last session, 2011, when you did the redistricting, You gave my district a huge benefit. It went across east from Highway 205 out to 112th and parts of it, and that captured some of the David Douglas School District, and one of the schools in that school district is the Earl Boyles Elementary Center, Elementary School. And I am really pleased to have this district that I now represent, along with three other House representatives, one of whom is here, and I'm pleased to be a part of this effort with my colleague, Jeff Reardon, and three other co-sponsors on this, Representative Fagan, Representative Vega Peterson, and Senator Monroe also represent parts of David Douglas School District. It's a very diverse, one of the most diverse school districts in the state of Oregon, has a very high poverty rate, and the district has incredible leadership in its superintendent, who is here today, and the Earl Boyles Elementary School also has incredible leadership with the principal, who's here today, and they have been involved in one of the pioneering efforts in Oregon to really connect the early learning to the K through 12 system, which is at the heart of what we're doing in this committee with the early learning efforts. So I'm just really pleased to be here to be a part of this bill, because one of the things that is needed, along with the programs and the professional development between the collaboration between the early childhood and the K through 12, and the curriculum development and the partnerships with the nonprofits and the business community, all of which is represented here, is they are expanding their facilities, and they had a bond in which $3 million out of the $6 million cost is covered by a bond by the residents of that district, and they are looking for the rest of the money, and this is not just helping this district. It's really showing an example of what we could do across the state in terms of connecting early childhood K through 12. So I'm very pleased to be here today.
Representative Tomei, our panel. My name is Jeff Reardon, Representative District 48, and very pleased that you'd have me here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 2984. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I know you know me, but I have been a resident of the David Douglas District for since 1978, so you can do the math on that one. Been there a long time. I have raised two daughters and two stepdaughters during that time, all graduated from David Douglas schools. I'm very proud of all of them. They all went on to Oregon universities and graduated. So they got a sound education in that system. I also was on David Douglas School Board for over 10 years, and had a great experience with the district there. I spent the last 10 years teaching for the district, so I think I know David Douglas pretty well, and I take a moment to explain that because I have tremendous pride in that district. In a moment, the rest of the panel will get up and they will talk more in detail about the project that we want to do. They're really the experts on early childhood education, but I just wanted to give you some idea of what this district is like and why it's a good place to develop a model. We do need a model to learn how to do early childhood education. I'm a former shop teacher and also have built a number of structures in my life, and I know that you need a good foundation, and that's where early childhood is so critical to play that role, and we need to learn how to do that and to learn how to do that well. So the state's looking for places to have this experience, and I can think of no place better than David Douglas to do that. There are other districts that are poised to do it. David Douglas is actually ready at this time. They're in the parlance of construction. They're shovel ready to be a demonstration project for the rest of the state. Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned community support. While I was running for the primary last year, my wife was running the bond campaign, and we both came out with about the same margins of victory, which was pretty good. And I really felt a lot of pride in that, but it was a tremendous effort from our household. But what's important for you to understand, this is a district that struggles financially. We have over 80% free and reduced lunch in that district. And yet, these people stepped up and said, it's important. They understand the importance of early childhood education. And they've done it in the past. They're doing it again. We've had full-day kindergarten for as long as I can remember. It came into effect. Senator Monroe was on our school board, and he was an advocate for that. And we voted it in. So I don't even know how long ago that was, but somewhere early 90s probably. And that's how long we've had free breakfast long before anyone else, I think, had even thought of it. And again, it was back when I was on the school board. I didn't understand the problem, but my school board members did, and David Douglas communities, again, they supported their kids. The point is, they've been leaders in taking care of kids. They have the opportunity, I think, to show some leadership in that again. And what's so really beautiful about this program is they are working with the rest of the community. So you're going to hear from parents today. You're going to hear from the principal of the school. You hear from the superintendent. And you hear from the Children's Institute, which is a broad base of community leaders that have been totally behind this project and really helping pull it together. So, you know, again, just to close, David Douglas is a great place for a pilot. It has a history of overcoming its challenges, and our students need this help. We are a very high number of immigrants, very high level of poverty. Yet, despite those challenges, the school district and the schools really perform well. We've made an investment as a community, and we're asking for a little bit of additional support from the state. By the way, we will also be hitting up our city, and we're going to other community members as well. We do need just a little bit of additional support, and so I would ask for your support of House Bill 2984, and you were talking about good models and doing things that are going to make you feel right earlier in your testimony. This is one of those. This is one where you can be very proud of helping build a model for the rest of the state and perhaps the rest of the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Call our first panel, Don Groding, is that right? Erica Guinness, maybe, and Krista Dennis. Start in whatever way you'd like, and please identify yourself.
Madam Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Don Groding, and I'm the superintendent of the David Douglas School District. I want to thank you for the time for me to come here and other folks to advocate for the Early Works Learning Center that will be an integral part of Earl Boyles Elementary School. Now, some of you may sit there and wonder, why in the heck would a K-12 superintendent in these times be advocating for early childhood education when we currently don't adequately fund our K-12 system? The answer is simple. It's the very best investment that we can make for our children and to close the achievement gap. We spend millions and millions of dollars trying to close the achievement gap, and to be honest, we're not doing a very good job of closing it. Once that gap's opened past the third grade, every child has a 60% greater chance not to graduate from high school. So at best, what we're doing is maintaining that gap, but we are not accelerating learning, and we're not making doing a very good job at closing the achievement gap. Just to give you a little bit of a history of David Douglas, in the last 3 years, I've had to lay off 130 teachers, 5 administrators, and the equivalent of about 60 classified folks. So when our community, our school district, decided to make an investment in early childhood education, we did our research. And the research tells us this is what we need to do. Here's a novel idea. Why should we be trying to close the achievement gap? Why don't we hit it on the front end and stop it from ever opening? As Representative Reardon alluded to, we speak over 80 different languages in our school. We have a free and reduced lunch rate approaching 90% in most of our elementary schools. These kids need that help as early as possible. And I want to make something evident. It's not only the kids, but we need to start engaging families and the students that we're going to serve as early as possible. We can't wait until they get to kindergarten. Another opportunity I believe that this early work center will have is it's just not about getting kids ready for kindergarten. There is a great opportunity here for the entire K-12 system throughout Oregon to ramp up the rigor, to meet Common Core standards, to have Oregon students ready to graduate with the best skills possible for them to achieve the 40-40-20 goals that we've outlined for them. And this is the way that we must do it. A child's brain is 90% developed by age 5. There's no way we can continue to sit and wait for kids to come to kindergarten 2, 3, sometimes 4 years letter and number deficient, recognition deficient, and then expect us to bring them up, and that gap is not going to be closed. The other thing I want to really emphasize, although I'm the David Douglas superintendent, this is not about David Douglas School District. This is not about Earl Boyle School District. This is about an opportunity to replicate something that's tangible for folks to be able to come from all over the state. We already have them coming from all over the nation. It will be the first of its kind, an education where a student in this catchment area will be served with their families from birth to age 5. And if we're able to do that, and Eric will talk a little bit, we already have data that shows this is the way to go. This is the way to help these kids, to give them the same opportunities that I imagine all of your kids had when they went to school, my kids had. These are children of color, and they're children of poverty. These are the kids who need an education the most. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee. I'd like to thank you for having us here this evening to speak to you about the Early Works initiative that's happening at Earl Boyle's. I am the fortunate principal of Earl Boyle's. Oh, I'm sorry, I got excited. my name is Erica Gidey, and I'm the principal at Earl Boyle's Elementary School in the David Douglas School District. I have the good fortune of being the principal at the school, and I've been an educator for 21 years now, and most of that was as a classroom teacher. So when Superintendent Grotting talks about the challenges about students coming to school with an achievement gap open and trying to close it, it's very real. Spent many, many years working with children and families trying to catch students up once they entered into the K-12 systems, and it was very difficult and evident by third grade that we were going to have challenges for those children in their futures. And right now, I have the opportunity of having a preschool on site, and within that preschool, It's a braided funded preschool partnering with Head Start and Early Intervention as our partners in the Children's Institute within the school. So we're currently serving 34 students, and they're 3 and 4 year olds, and we have 2 sessions per day. And it's not just about a preschool, as Superintendent Grotting had mentioned. It's truly about building a community hub within our school. And one thing I'd like to kind of showcase is that from this, just this short time that we've had the preschool open, our parent engagement and involvement with the community has increased significantly. Not only that, but for the gains for our children and the stability that they're seeing as 3 and 4 year olds has been significant. I brought some data with you just to let you know a little bit about what we're doing there.
Right now, our preschool's attendance data for 3 and 4-year-olds is at 98%. Now, that is the highest in the school, and if you do comparative with, I believe it's Head Start data, and we're looking nationally, I think it's 40%, to give you some idea about what the difference is. And I feel that because we are linking and connecting with our parents as partners, and Representative Gilliam had talked about partnership earlier, that is what's making a difference. Our parents are coming in and volunteering, and it's not just about showing up and being there for their children to learn, but they're actively engaged. We go into home visits as a component of the program, and parents are saying, well, what can I do to prepare our children? Because truly, we are meeting our families as true partners, and Krista Dennis, one of our parents, is here today to talk a little bit about that, but it's truly making a difference for our community, and it's not just about Earl Boyles. The other day I had a parent come in and she said, I know the laws, I know open enrollment's happening right now, and I demand that my child come over to your preschool. Even though we're not here, I know it's best for your, you know, for my child. The communities know there's a need to connect sooner with schools. And the families have that sense. The schools have that sense. And we just need to be able to build that bridge between that early childhood and family, starting from birth onto high school, you know, graduation from high school and on to college. But I think until we provide that opportunities for families to build that hubs within the schools, that we can really make a difference for them. I'd also like to let you know that some of the other data that we have is that we have 44% of our students, and I'm talking 3 and 4-year-olds, already know 20-plus letter sounds. 30% can identify their numbers from 1 to 10. We also have about 50% can write their names independently. So we have significant data already academically that those students, that 3 and 4-year-olds, are going to come into kindergarten with more skills than some of our students that are in kindergarten currently cannot do at this time of the year. Because at this point, we had 68% of our students that did not have an opportunity to experience any kind of formal child care or educational setting prior to coming to kindergarten right now. So we're seeing lots of benefits to the program within the community, but also for long-term as well, because we also know that, for example, with our braided funding, we have so many slots for Head Start, 14, 10 slots for early intervention, and 10 for our typical peers. But what's also happening with that is we're having an opportunity to reach into families and identify needs much sooner. So out of those 10 typical peers, 7 were identified as having early intervention needs. And we were able to reach into the families and support those children to make a difference before they come into our K-12 systems and require special education services. So really, it is a long-term investment in our children and our families, but it's a good investment to make. Also, I just want to conclude with that we do know that the benefits of investing in early childhood education are, and they're somewhere between the 1 and 10 returns on investment levels. They've included having kids better prepared for third grade benchmarks. We've also incurred less in special ed cost, higher high school graduation rates and post-secondary participation, lower social costs to teen pregnancy and juvenile criminal justice interactions. Prevention goes a long ways to avoid some of the costs that we are already incurring in education currently. And if we invest in our children to change our future and raise our community to a higher standard of living, we can make a difference for all of our families. And I've heard many of the presenters earlier today talking about decreasing the cost of for families and the cost for investing into children. And I think we do need to take a look at building a model for our state, because currently we really don't have that. And I have people contact me all the time from other districts asking, how are you doing this? Because they know it could have an impact as well. Thank you for your time, and I hope you will consider this.
Erica, when did the program start?
The actual preschool, it opened in the fall. It It was the first year this year. Right. So we've been working with the Children's Institute since 2010, doing some visioning and work and gathering our partners. We're a Sun School, so we really do try to collaborate with our resources and utilize that as one spot. So what we're lacking in the K-12 system, we're finding in our partners. And so I really think that by having that as a community hub and a place for all families to come and access services, Oregon Food Bank, we're a food pantry, it really centralizes resources.
You say 98% of the children are attending. So is that 98% of the children who have signed up, or is that 98% of the children in the district in that age group?
In that preschool, so every day on time, they're there every day on time.
Did they sign up? Parents came in to sign them up, these three-year-olds or four-year-olds?
Yes.
Well, so it's 98% of the children who have signed up in September, is that correct?
Correct.
It's not 98% of the kids in the catchment area. Okay.
No.
Just wanted to add up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. One quick question. I thought you might just say a word about going back to Harvard. What you were able to bring back in terms of resources to our community here, our state.
Yes. I'm sorry. I don't know how much time I had to talk. I was talking really fast. It's just been an incredible journey for the whole experience. In 2010, when I started working with the Children's Institute, the K-12 system, and I'm speaking for myself, so I don't mean to generalize, but, in being in education for that long, in the K-12 system, I really didn't have an understanding of the early childhood and the strengths that they could bring to the system if we link them and build that bridge. So the Children's Institute provided an opportunity to go back to the Harvard to go to an early childhood institute for a week to learn about that, to hear the current research and what a difference it could make for children and families. And Superintendent Grodding was with me, and I remember sitting at a picnic table thinking, and after hearing all that research, and Swadia Dakar, the president of the Children's Institute, was there, and I was thinking, I think I remember saying, I think we can do this. And the bigger question is, why aren't we doing something? Why aren't we doing something to reach into our families and partner early? Because we can work really hard and spend a whole lot of money trying to remediate children from third grade on, and we're not making that difference. We have an opportunity to make a difference here. I mean, really make a difference. And I think by seeing that research and seeing what was out there and the opportunity to be able to link it to a K-12 system and to see the benefits this year for our children, it's had a profound impact on the community of our K-12 system. I have fifth grade teachers complimenting our preschool teachers saying, thank you, because I know when that child gets to me in fifth grade, I'm going to be able to do wonderful things with this child and this family. And the relationship's already there with the families.
How many children are enrolled?
34 in our preschool, but we hope with the wing that we would be able to serve up to 60, all of them in our community.
Hopefully 60. Okay, and Representative Gelsinger.
Every kid in our catchment, every student in the catchment area. That's our dream. That's our dream.
Representative Gelser and I and the speaker also went to this program some years ago.
Representative Wiston.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Representative Wiston. Mm-hmm. He slipped out.
You're absolutely right.
Thank you. Yeah. So we understand what it is, the experience that you had. It was very profound.
It was wonderful. Yes. I mean, it truly changed. It shifted the way I was thinking as an educator.
Yes.
It really did. And it also shifted the need, because I also would see from K-12 when students come in, whether they're in Head Start or other early childhood experiences, it wasn't communicated. There wasn't a natural link. And we truly are having conversations now with Head Start around Common Core and what are parents, what are we communicating to parents and how are we bridging that? And if a child is coming in with early intervention needs or special needs, how is that being communicated to continue that level of support so the child can be successful instead of passed from hand to hand without a consistent plan for that child's success?
How are you identifying the children who invited to be into the program?
That's a great question. Well, as I stated, it's been a little challenging at the very beginning because we really didn't advertise very much because we only have one classroom. We had an empty classroom, and that's how we're fortunate enough to have this preschool in our school. And we didn't really advertise. We just by word of mouth, and it filled up very quickly. So we worked with our partners, Head Start and MESD, and they had selected, you know, it's just students in our catchment area, so I want to be clear with that. And we didn't advertise, so we had lots of applications, and we took the first ones we could. We did a balance of 3- and 4-year-olds, and we have quite a late waiting list right now currently of kids. So that's how we just kind of took them as they came, and once they were full, we were full. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I do have a question, I guess, or questions. You know, I appreciate the bill we brought to us, and appreciate our colleagues bringing this to us. And it seems like some of other people on the committee here have did a tour and stuff, so there apparently there's some knowledge, prior knowledge about this that some of us, others of us, don't have. And frankly, I would have appreciated if this would have been presented more as a pilot project for the state. I mean, it sounds like a great opportunity to really learn from, but when it was presented as a particular school district, I mean, all of us in our districts have schools and areas that are low income, et cetera, et cetera. And so I guess that would have been helpful to understand from the beginning that this is a pilot demonstration project that we might be able to then learn from in terms of the state. So the other part of my question really has to do with the research itself and the curriculum and who's overseeing the evaluation study, who's overseeing the outcomes and so on. I didn't really get any of that, but
okay, I can back that up. We're also partnering with, through the Children's Institute, Portland State University, in which they are doing all of the evaluation of the long-term evaluation of the project. So we started with a pretty intensive community needs assessment, and I would be happy to send that over. I'm not sure who I send it to, but I would be happy to share that information. Yes, a very extensive community needs assessment. And within that, they interviewed community parents, partners, all of my staff. So really taking a look at what does the community need? And is it ready for this type of a pilot project? Are we, you know, is this something that we truly need? And it very clearly and evidently spoke to the community members wanted the same thing as the K-12. So there is a lot of research out there. Portland State is doing ongoing evaluation. They actually come in and interview parents and continue with assessments with the children. Right. As far as curriculum, we're working, our district curriculum director is working with us, and we are currently aligning, looking at early childhood standards and domains and aligning them with the Common Core that's come in.
That would be great.
Follow up?
So, yeah, and I see that the Regional Research Institute is involved from the School of Social Work. So, yeah, I think that's all great. And I think I'd like to see that needs assessment and also, you know, the outcome and objectives that you're assessing, particularly with the perspective. What I'd like to look at, what I want to see is how these are then generalizable to the rest of the state, and how we can really use this model if we're going to invest in it, you know, throughout the state.
Mm-hmm. One of the things they're finding is they are finding key components or strategies that are successful. Pieces on parent engagement is one. Summer learning loss is the other. Home visiting components. So what we are finding are there are pieces that whether or not they have those facility, you know, a facility, there are pieces that are key and essential in building those early partnerships early. And that's part of that whole evaluation that we're finding, because truly it is so new to do something like a community hub and a preschool within a K-12 system. But there are pieces and nuggets that people are finding, and they're going, I can do that right now. And I do get calls from other districts, and Superintendent Grodin can speak to that. He probably gets more calls than I do. But, you know, they can use nuggets. And I think that's the piece that we want to talk about. It is not just about, I mean, I'm lucky because it's at Arbor Boils, but it's not just about that.
Right.
It's truly about what pieces can we apply to our other districts in the state of Oregon to make a difference for all of our children?
Thank you very much, Erica. You're welcome. We'd like to hear from Krista.
Hi, please excuse me. I have a cold. Representatives, my name is Krista Dennis, and my son is a five-year-old in the preschool. He's five because he missed the cutoff for kindergarten by 2 hours and 45 minutes. my son, when he went into the program, he had already had 3 years of previous preschool. He had two with a private preschool and one at a MESD preschool to deal with symptoms with autism, to deal with behavioral issues. When he went into the Earl Boyles preschool, he could barely count to five. He could recognize some letters, some numbers, most of his colors, some shapes. Now about eight months later, he knows his letters forwards and backwards. He's very proud of that. he can count to 15. He can do simple addition and subtraction. He knows all of his letter sounds and has started to read. One of my favorite stories that I tell is he was walking past the kindergarten classroom, and they were learning the same thing that he knew in the preschool, and as he was walking by the open door, he shouted out the answer into the kindergarten classroom. And that's what involved mom, you know, walking beside him, and was like, no, honey, you can't answer that. but I want to go a little bit more into the early intervention. Early intervention, my son was lucky that in his previous preschools, I was able to get him diagnosed early. And it was at 3 years old. So it's the age that we're talking about in our preschool is that, you know, intervention is critical, especially at that age, getting the behavior down, getting them ready for school, giving them that school experience before they get into the kindergarten curriculum and they're needing to learn all of these things. That is, if you've ever looked at a kindergarten curriculum, it's huge. And for a child that's just getting diagnosed with Asperger's, ADHD, autism, it's a massive headache for both parents and for the children. And this would just help them a lot.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions? Anyone on the panel? Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
And Erica, be really helpful. I think following up some of the questions of Representative Gallegos, maybe sort of the things that you mentioned, the evaluation, the community needs assessment, all those just short one pages that we can read very quickly would be wonderful. Thank you. The evaluation, great.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, and now we will have Lynn Lundquist, who knows this building very well, and Dr. David Mandel. Welcome back, Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lynn Lundquist. Today I'm speaking on behalf of the Children's Institute and the Ready for School campaign. Last time I was here, I spoke about House Bill 2013, which is for the Early Learning Strategic Grants. These bills are very much tied together. I'll just say, start with, I'm keenly aware, having sat in those chairs before, it's not Friday, but it's Wednesday afternoon, and it's getting close to 5, so I'll be as brief as possible, okay? The message today I want to leave is really very, very simple. We need a trailblazer in the early learning arena. That's the message I'd like to have you remember. You know, whenever you talk about doing something different, whether it's the pioneers or crossing the Midwest and settled in the West, or when we were first doing research on renewable resources, or even in the earlier testimony you had on the previous bill, in regard to how we can better the lives of foster children, someone needs to carve the path. And that's what Earl Boyles is trying to do. And Representative Gallegos, when you spoke earlier, you know, about this, the one district doing this and so forth, when you stop and think about it, we are so fortunate as a state to have one district that stepped out and started this before anyone else really was pushing it. So, I mean, I think we have a real advantage in that situation. They happen to be in that path. They happen to be carving the path. I think that's just outstanding. from the standpoint of the state getting involved in this, and, you know, I realize it's taxpayers' money from all over the state, but what has happened so far, basically it's been without the state, and I happen to be, conservative, Republican enough, or whatever, that whenever you have some skin in the game, I think things come out better. And I think the state puts some skin in the game here, that you'll watch it, exactly the questions that you had. So, yes, Earl Boyles is in the Tri-County area, but whether it's representing Whisna or representing Whisset, both of those districts as well, being very far flung from the Tri-County area, are going to benefit off of that, off of this. So, again, we need a trailblazer. Earl Boyles stepping up to the plate. I think it's a great partnership that we can develop.
Thank you, Ben. Any questions of Mr. Lundquist? Representative
Whisset. I have something I'd like to say. I appreciate everyone being here, and I appreciate the bill. I have an elementary school in my district that was destroyed by mold several years ago, and the children are going to school in trailer houses. It's 20 below zero outside. We don't have a building to put our children in, and I think that from my standpoint, the first thing that we should do is make sure that our children in this state have buildings where they can actually go to school. And so, I mean, I really appreciate this, but you have to look at some of these areas that the kids don't even have buildings to attend. So, I mean, I just need to say that. It's very important. They can't get the bonds passed down there. We have extremely high poverty, extremely high numbers of minority and migrant worker children, and we have no place for them to go to attend other than these little trailer houses. So, I mean, I just really feel it's necessary to prioritize what we're doing.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be before your committee today. My name is David Mandel. I'm the Policy and Research Director at the Children's Institute. And I thought I would take a little time today, and I'll be brief as well, to talk a little bit about how the Children's Institute is really using the work at Earl Boyles and also in a companion site at Yonkala Elementary School near Roseburg to really document and leverage this for change throughout the state. We really also see this as a companion piece to a proposal that we've put forward around early learning strategic grants that I believe will be part of the discussion around HB 213 to really provide incentives for districts and schools around the state to engage in the work that Earl Boyles is helping blaze. But I would also want to say a little bit about the role of the Children's Institute. I mean, we've really up until we engaged in this project, have been deeply involved in state policy work, particularly around early learning. I've sat on lots of these state committees involved in work to improve child care quality, around kindergarten readiness assessment. So the Children's Institute really comes at this from the perspective of trying to think about how to use this as an opportunity to shape policy. You know, and what I would say is part of the background of that, and it's really emerged as a conversation I had this morning with some superintendents, we're really in a situation where we have an education system and we have a non-system for early childhood. And there's some really great work happening under the auspices of the Early Learning Council to make that early childhood into a system. But what needs to happen simultaneously is really figure out how to build that connection between the early learning piece and the K-12 piece. And I think that's what this is really, this work is really about. But let me also want to talk about what the role of the Children's Institute is really in helping make sure that this really is leverage for policy change. We've had a little bit of discussion about the evaluation that we've been working on with PSU. That's not only looking at children and family outcomes, trying to document whether we're going to see improvements in kindergarten readiness and third grade scores, but they're also looking at how these pieces are getting built and what's the kind of transformation that this is making possible at the school, and they're also doing a similar process at the Yonkala site that I also mentioned. The Children's Institute is also really committed to documenting and communicating and sharing the lessons learned. So I think one of the pieces, I'll just give this as a quick example and end there, is one of the key strategies for the preschool is to build that on existing public resources, public funding streams. So that's a blended and braided classroom that involves Head Start resources, early childhood special ed resources, as well as school resources. What we found is that blending and braiding allows you to bring the best of all those programs together and really support kids in a shared setting, but that it's also incredibly hard and that it shouldn't be as hard as it is. So part of what we're also doing is documenting that. So we're going to come back to you. We're going to release a report on what we learned in that blending and braiding. And by next legislative session, we're going to come back to you with some recommendations so that it's not so easy for the next school that tries to do it. So just giving you guys a little background of how we're thinking about this as part of that model for statewide change.
Could you explain what blending and braiding is?
So the classroom, the preschool, there are dollars from Head Start that are paying for children who are Head Start eligible, and Mount Hood Community College Head Start's at the table. There are children that are eligible for early childhood special education, and they're being funded by those dollars, and they're at the table. And all those programs have different rules. And blending and braiding means, this in some sense is a braided classroom because we have kids with all those funding streams, but we're also making sure that all the rules that correspond to those funding streams are being operated in that classroom. So that's what braiding is. So even though it's one setting, it's really independent sources of funding, as well as the set of rules and regulations that go along with each of those funding streams. And I think that's part of why this is really a public policy effort, as much as anything.
Not sure.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And I do want to say that I'm certainly a fan and convinced that early childhood education is critical. Early childhood intervention is critical if we want to deal with the issues that we're facing. I'm also on the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Committee. And clearly for me, it really workforce development starts here. And so I do appreciate the passion that you all have and the presentations you made. I think, as I said, though, I think you have to appreciate how sensitive I think we all are to school funding and the budgets that we're dealing with right now. So, you know, how do we then squeeze out every little dollar or dime out of every stone we can turn over? But please don't take that as a message that we don't appreciate your effort. And to me, what I'm looking for is how does this then translate into a benefit for the state? I mean, that's simply where I'm coming from. Thank you.
Any further representatives?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues. We were sitting here over here thinking that's our freshman status, that maybe we didn't present it as a pilot project as much as we should have. So we're taking that on ourselves. Last year we had an effort around trying to fund the Vernonia schools, which had an emergency situation. And we found one of the things that I learned was that the state doesn't really do any help with construction, as most other states do. I think we're one of the very few states that do very little. And there had been a fund that had set up, but it had never gone through the rulemaking process, and no money had been put into it that we were able to activate. And I think I forget the exact number, but there was about $500,000 left in that you might want to look at in terms of emergency school funding. That's what the fund was set up for. Representative Betty Comp has a bill right now that sets up bonding capacity for K-12 schools, and one of the things that we want to ensure is that that's available for K-12 schools that are also trying to reach out to preschool capacity too, because what this pilot project is really a place-based project. If we really want to do this transition of early childhood into K-12, what are the models that we can create, and what are the kind of funding streams that we need to structurally put in place so we can have a real partnership between the state and the school districts and nonprofits and businesses? I think everyone's at the table with this. So a lot of this effort is what is structurally needed in place. And I think that piece of it is really important as we go forward. There's always going to be some emergency needs, and I would vigorously support the emergency needs funding, but we also, in addition to that, need to look at what is it that we're trying to create, what's our vision, and how do we support that, how do we partner, and having communities pass their own bond at whatever level and having some skin in the game is a part of, I think, Representative Betty Comp. Now, there can be varying levels given capacity in communities, but those are the things that I think we're trying to look at going forward, because it's really hard in communities such as yours to do it on your own. I mean, it's virtually impossible. And so those are some of the things that we're trying to figure out long term.
Might I respond, Madam Chair, just very quickly? You have a very tough job. You have very hard decisions to make. But I guess it's my economic background that I know in my farming, which is very capital intensive and very difficult to make any money in, if you don't make those critical investments along the way, even though, you know, it might take for someplace else, that's a decision you have to make, and that's, in my opinion, that I guess I'm passionate about this, but I don't know how we get out of the box we are in for the cost of K-12 without doing something more effectively up front so that we could lower the costs overall. I mean, that's just what it's about. And so I apologize for taking a second shot at it here, Madam
no
Chair.
Problem.
But I'm passionate about that, and that's what we have to do as a state.
Some people may not realize that Representative Lundquist had been here in the Capitol for a very long time and has dealt with these issues a very long time. And we appreciate you're here, and we appreciate all the information you bring from a long period of time.
Thank you.
So thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. Thanks, everybody. And there was a woman in the front row who kept nodding her head as people were talking. So I thought we were going to hear from her, but no way. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2984 and close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you. Mm-hmm.